Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
Yeah, so this was around my sophomore year of college, which was about 2013, I want to say. I remember running into this older white lady, but she ended up asking me where I was from, which is a question that I got a lot in college, and I told her I was from Kenya, and then she preemptively asked me if I was Kikuyu, and Kikuyu is the name of my tribe, and I said, yeah, I am, and it was very weird because a lot of people didn't know that about me, especially like random white people on the street, so I was sort of impressed.
Hey, I'm Gabriel Spitzer, it's Sound Effect, and this is Gladys Gitao Damascos. We talked over Skype. She's a teacher in Massachusetts, but at this time she was a student at Whitman College in Walla Walla. It's not a place Gladys was used to strangers recognizing her background. It felt pretty good.
She ended up speaking to me in what it was either Swahili or Kikuyu. So we sort of had a conversation. I was like, oh, okay, so... you're not just going to tell me about your friend from Nigeria or your friend from South Africa. Like, you actually know where I'm from. And then I asked her, like, how'd you know? And she said that she had lived in Kenya for many years and that she had owned a plantation for about 20 years. It went from being like, oh, I'm being recognized in this way that I've never recognized ever, really, to being like, oh, I really don't want to investigate how you know this information. So the British were occupying Kenya for a really long time. They had a lot of tea plantations, and they had sort of enslaved the local population of Kenyan people, and especially the Kikuyu people, who were the most resistive to the British, were being tortured and maimed and castrated in these really, really violent ways. And then there was this uprising called the Mau Mau Uprising, which is pretty much what was a catalyst for the British leaving. But still, a lot of white landowners stayed. They still had, you know, positions of power. And like, my family has a history of like living on land that was owned by white folks who stayed after British rule in Kenya. And then my mom used to work on like a coffee plantation for a really long time and like barely got paid as a girl. My knowledge of how that land operated isn't necessarily something that I wanna, you know, like relive or see in a positive way. Yeah, I mean, there was something sweet about it. Somebody asking me where I was from and genuinely being able to engage. And I did feel special for a second, for sure. And now that I'm older, I wish I had like had a, like a more productive dialogue with her and had not just like shut down and, you know, taken that as a bad memory, for sure. And I think it led me to ask a lot more questions to my mom, to my dad, about their land, their family, their heritage, and my own history. So I think it was like a pivotal moment for me.
There's that moment of understanding when you encounter a stranger and suddenly you're speaking the same language. It can be the spark of a friendship, or in this case, point to an even wider gulf between you. Today on Sound Effect, our theme is Found in Translation, stories of making ourselves understood, for better or for worse. One of the places in our region where different languages and cultures mix is SeaTac. Not the airport, the town. The census shows more than 70 languages are spoken there by immigrants from Somalia, Ethiopia, Mexico, all over. And yet the local government is still dominated by white people. A new slate of city council candidates says the city's leadership needs to reflect that diversity. But as Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing reports, the closer you look, the more complicated the picture gets. She starts out at a local landmark that's become a flashpoint for a changing community.
One location in SeaTac where residents and city officials have struggled to find understanding and connection is the Bakaro Mall. From the outside, the Bakaro Mall, which is also known as SeaTac Center, is a large rectangular building. Inside, there are more than 50 shops connected by long hallways. The stores are sectioned into compact spaces the size of small offices. For the last 15 years, this is where Somali Muslims from near and far have come to buy clothes, religious books, and specialty foods like tilapia samosas and camel's milk. Jamila Farole's mother has operated her store here for 11 years.
This place is it's a cultural center for all of us, for the Somali community in particular. It's a place where weddings take place. It's like a place where community gatherings happen. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you can buy your wedding outfit here and you can celebrate upstairs in the hall that is up above
us. And have it made by the tailor. Yeah, a tailor that's across the hall from my mom.
Sure enough, right across the hall, pants are being hemmed. Almost all of the small businesses inside the Bakara Mall are owned by Somali women. The city of SeaTac owns the property. The city is selling it to a developer for $15 million. The plan is to build 600 multifamily units with retail space on the first floor. 60% of the units will be affordable housing. I am here in late August, and in a few days from this visit, everything in these shops will be gone. In another store, several women are packing up boxes of dresses and scarves.
I'm crying today.
Yeah, she cried. Everybody crying today. So we lose all our stuff, our life. They mess up everything.
This is Ishmahan Mohammed. She's been here for 9 years.
We package a lot of stuff. We're going to take the goodwill. We don't have choice. Nobody helping us.
Ishmahan is angry that the place where she and fellow Somali women worked together and socialized is closing. She's mad at the members of SeaTac's city council for selling the building. Ishmahan and others in the Somali community feel that the mostly white city council is trying to bring Donald Trump politics to SeaTac, where minorities make up the majority.
The leader of SeaTac, they're not supposed to sit in that chair. They has to move that chair because most people live in SeaTac is immigrant, is the African, and we are citizen. We not vote for them the way they treat us.
If it was just that simple, good guys over here, bad guys over there, but it's not. The city notified the tenants of the Bakara Mall more than a year in advance that the property was going to be sold. The city offered to help them find new places nearby. The Refugee Women's Alliance, a nonprofit that works with immigrant communities, had an office in the mall, and with the city's help, it moved to SeaTac City Hall. SeaTac City Councilman Peter Kwan, who is Korean-American, is one of the incumbents up for re-election and is the sole minority on the council. He says that the people who were on the lease for the Bakara Mall, members of the Somali community, kept subtenants like Jamila's mom and Ishmahan in the dark.
A lot of the businesses had the belief that they could stay forever. So that was very heartbreaking.
Back in 2017, Peter says that he found a way to preserve some of the businesses in the mall. About three blocks away from the Bakara Mall, in the city of Tukwila, SeaTac's neighbor, a nonprofit called Forterra was planning to construct an international marketplace.
This seemed like a really, really win-win solution.
Peter says that everyone in the Bakara Mall had to be on board with the plan.
A couple of weeks went by, I didn't hear from them, so I went back and I said, hey, what's going on with this? And I was told the businesses were not interested. That was sadly an opportunity lost.
Depending on how you interpret them, there are reasons why the Somali community might not trust city leaders. In 2016, the city council invited Washington State Representative Matt Shea from the Spokane area to hear his advice on whether the city should take a federal grant. At the time, Shea was strongly linked with the anti-Muslim group Act for America and has close ties to far-right extremists that promote political violence. Also in 2016, SeaTac's former city manager, James Donnie Payne, was accused of wanting to make a map to know where Shiite and Sunni Muslims lived in case he'd have to go in and make the peace. Payne has publicly denied this, saying he was trying to gather information about the city's residents so that the city could better serve their needs. Then there is the photo of SeaTac's mayor, Erin Sitterly, that was on her Facebook page. She's holding a shotgun and wearing a pink baseball cap with the word infidel displayed on the front. She says the photo was taken over a decade ago, years before she got into politics, and that, yes, she owns a gun and knows how to shoot it. She didn't say anything about what was written on the hat. All of this doesn't sit very well with Damiana Merriweather. Damiana is a white middle-aged woman who runs four Korean fried chicken restaurants with her husband while they raise two small kids. She's running against incumbent council member Peter Kwan. She says just one of these examples could easily be shrugged off as a moment of bad judgment. But when you lump it all together, she sees a pattern.
I am very sensitive about accusing any person or group of people of something as loaded as being racist or being xenophobic or being anti-immigrant. But sometimes if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, there is no reasonable conclusion but to say it must be a duck.
The argument that there might be a problem with the majority white council representing a mostly minority community is one that Peter Kwan has heard before. Peter says a few years ago, he had a conversation about this with a member of the Somali community. Her name was Amina Ahmed. Peter remembers Amina coming up to him at the end of a council meeting and telling him how wonderful it was that he, a Korean American, was on the council. She said the community needed a minority representing them.
And my first question to Amina was, why do you feel that way? Do you feel that because other folks on the council do not look like you, that they don't represent you? Because I don't see it that way. And she said, well, it's not about whether they do represent you or not. It's about the perception, right? So if they kind of look like me, then, you know, whether they have opposing views, you might still feel represented. I get that.
Peter and Amina kept the dialogue open. He asked her for advice on how to make immigrants and refugees feel more welcome in SeaTac. He says she was the inspiration behind a resolution that says SeaTac is committed to diversity. The council passed it unanimously. Peter says that he went out into the community asking people how they might like to get involved with city government. Interest really ticked up when the idea for an arts and culture committee was brought up.
Most folks said, yeah, that would be great. You know, that's something I'm interested in. You know, I want to be able to promote my culture. I want to be able to put on, community art shows or whatever.
Peter and Amina worked on neighborhood cleanups. They worked on trying to get grants and on finding ways to get SeaTac residents higher paying jobs. Then a seat opened up on city council. More than a dozen people applied. Amina was at the top of the list.
Amina was the only one that had years of history of actually working with the community and being involved with local government.
Okay, we'll go on to agenda item number one. So Judge Robert Hamilton will swear Amina Ahmed in.
Amina attended four council meetings.
So my question was, is there a city process in regards to reviewing contracts with any agencies that the city contracts with?
In regards 2 months later, Amina died. She was killed in a car accident. After her death, Peter said the goal was to fill the position with someone familiar with how things work. Someone like Amina. Her replacement was a white man named Stanley Toombs. Damiana Merriweather, Peter Kwan's opponent, thinks this appointment was a misstep.
Fundamentally, I believe that for representative democracy to work, it needs to actually be representative, which means we need parents of very noisy young children on our city council. We need members of our immigrant and minority community. We need old people. We need young people. We need brown people. We need white people. And that is where we get government that actually prioritizes the things that are important to the people who they govern.
Before Amina Ahmed died, she had a one-on-one meeting with the mayor, Aaron Sitterly. In an email, Aaron says that the list of ideas from that meeting between her and Amina, two women from very different backgrounds but who called the same place home, that list still guides the work of the council today. Aaron says that it's important to note that Amina was in full support of the redevelopment of Bacaro Mall. She says Amina urged the Somali businesses to move out and hoped they would come back once the new retail spaces were built. And remember that Arts and Culture Committee that the city created to try and get more involvement from SeaTac's incredibly diverse community? Peter Kwan says that out of the 7 seats that were open, 6 were filled by white men and women, and 1 by a person of color, just like the current city council.
That story from Sound Effects, Jennifer Wing. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and our theme today is Found in Translation. When I first saw him, he looked wildly out of context. This was a place of ice and tundra, of weathered brown skin and tan Carhartts, but this guy showed up in neon-colored rain gear with hippie jewelry and zero explanation of what he was doing there. And he couldn't really tell us because he only spoke Japanese. I was an outsider too. A reporter based in Anchorage, Alaska, I had traveled hundreds of miles to this remote community up against the Arctic Circle. The village is made up almost entirely of Inupiaq Eskimo people who have lived there for countless generations. I was staying in a double-wide trailer, which was the only lodging available in Shishmaref. And on a gray October afternoon, this brightly colored visitor showed up. A local guy had walked him over from the airstrip and was eager to hand him off. "What's he doing here?" I asked. The local guy shrugged, indicating the new guy would be staying in the trailer, and took off. Takesh was friendly enough. "I am carpenter," he explained with the help of his phrasebook. "Summer, I am bartender." Now, it's hard to overstate how unlikely it is that you just wind up at a place like Shishmaref. There are no roads to the rest of the world. Just to get here from Anchorage, you have to take 3 airplanes. There are 2 general stores, a small leather tannery, and not much else. And there's no plumbing in most of the village. Instead, people poop in what they call honey buckets. Over the course of the afternoon, Takesh and I managed to reconstruct the basics. He was from Tokyo, and he was traveling through Alaska, retracing the steps of a famous Japanese photographer decades before. Takesh had a pretty nice camera himself. After a little while, he went off to go explore the village to take pictures of ramshackle houses, racks of drying fish, and curing seal meat. The main people who visit Shishmaref tend to be reporters, like me, and scientists, both groups drawn by the fact that Shishmaref is on the front lines of climate change. Increased flooding and coastal erosion are eating away at this ancient community, and the people were being forced to consider picking up their village and putting it down somewhere safe. There was one other category of regular visitors, and that was contractors. During my stay, I shared living quarters with 2 of these guys, laborers named Guy and Dick. They were in from Nome, and they were of stereotypical Alaskan old white guy stock. Guy was tall and chatty, with a thick horseshoe mustache. Dick was white-haired and wiry, and wore flannel shirts and mesh ball caps. In the evening, they'd mix cocktails, secretly, it's a dry village, and tell stories of itinerant work around rural Alaska. By late afternoon, they rolled in from a day of work at the tannery, and I informed them about our new roommate. Guy's eyebrows went up, he glanced at Dick, shrugged his shoulders, and headed into his room. But Dick, on the other hand, scowled. "Japanese," he grumbled. "They're trained to hate us, you know. I like everybody, but I hate the Japanese." Now, I grew up in the 80s in Ohio and had been exposed to a wide variety of bigotry, and this was 2004 when post-9/11 tensions were still sizzling. Still, wasn't prejudice against Japan a little out of date? But Dick had grown up in a different era, less World Trade Center, more Pearl Harbor. "I won't stay here with him. I mean it. I'll go sleep in the tannery." Dick retreated into his little bedroom, and I did the thing I do when I'm caught off guard by racism. I had a vigorous argument with myself over how much to challenge it. Dick's opinions were baked in 1941, so didn't seem likely that I could talk him out of them. But Takesh was also coming back in a few hours, so I decided that if Dick gave him a hard time, at least I'd push back. As I waited, I couldn't help but think about the generation of Americans defined not by World War II, but by 9/11. And I wondered whether 60 years from now, people my age would be refusing to share a roof with visitors from Muslim countries. Meanwhile, I waited for this very strange racial clash between a white guy and a Japanese guy set in a double-wide trailer on the edge of the continent. By the time Takesh returned, my head was spinning. A younger local guy named Dennis was with him and had seemingly adopted Takesh as his charge. This may have changed Dick's calculations, because when he opened up his door, he didn't unload on Takesh, who now had local reinforcements. Or maybe Dick just understood what I'd already concluded, that airing generations-old racial grievances in a remote Inupiaq Eskimo village was kind of ridiculous. Anyway, Dick collected his day bag and skulked out of the trailer, and I don't think he spent another night there. Meanwhile, Takesh was attempting to teach Dennis how to fold an origami paper crane, and I joined in. We were pretty bad at it, and soon we were laughing and communicating in exaggerated hand gestures and broken Japanese. Dennis gave him a pair of reindeer hide slippers, and I showed him how my radio gear worked. It became easy, much less labored than trying to hold a conversation with Dick and Guy over illicit cocktails. Days later, a major storm slammed into Shishmaref. The ocean took huge bites out of the dwindling coastline. This was the changing climate having its way with a small, vulnerable village. Dennis and I zoomed around on his four-wheeler while the storm raged so I could do my reporting. And at one point, Dennis spotted something in the surf and grabbed it. It was a little green glass globe, a fishing net float with a Japanese character on it. This ball had drifted all the way across the Pacific Ocean, up through the Bering Straits, and come to rest unannounced on this faraway shore. Kind of like someone else I know. Later, we took the glass ball back to the trailer and asked Takesh to translate the character. Takesh scrunched up his eyebrows. He flipped through one paperback dictionary, then another. Finally, he shut the book and, beaming, delivered a translation that also described the world I was living in. Small. Sound Effect on KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's theme is Found in Translation. One of the great communication gaps in modern society isn't between immigrants and non-immigrants, or conservatives and liberals. It's between teenagers and their parents. For a young person, feeling like the adults in their lives just don't understand is so common that it's become a cliche. And it also sometimes happens to be true. The teen in this next story grew up in White Center, just south of Seattle. And when he says his mom and dad don't understand him, he really means it. Sound Effect contributor Max Wasserman has the story.
Tristan Agosa always felt like he was missing something while he was growing up. Then he watched this movie, Boys in the Hood.
Either they don't know, don't show, don't care about what's going on in the hood.
If you haven't seen the movie, it's a pretty bleak coming-of-age story. There's gang violence, racism, but that's not the part Tristan related to. He latched on to one of the film's few bright spots. It has to do with the main character Trey and his dad, Furious. The two have this really sweet relationship.
So tell me, are you a leader or a follower,
I'm a leader!
Okay then, what's the three rules?
There's a scene where, like, Fury and his kid are fishing.
I got it. I always look a person in the eye.
The way, like, the kid, like, looked at his dad with, like, admiration and, like, great respect and, just, and like, love. And that's, like, something I really wanted. And I was like, jealous, sort of. So I looked at Fury and I was just like, I wish that was my dad.
It's hard for Tristan to have a conversation with either of his own parents. His mom doesn't know much English. She speaks Tagalog. He does not. So they communicate through gestures, which works for the most part. His dad was born in the Philippines too, but the problem with him isn't language. He speaks English. It's even more basic than that. Take, for example, this one time Tristan was in high school, so not that long ago. He walked into his parents' room and gave this speech.
I'm going to tell you something. It's really, really important to me. I've thought about this for a while, and I really would prefer if you guys don't get angry at me. And they're like, okay, what? And I tell them, like, I'm bisexual. And then the next thing you know, like, I just, like, look, I noticed that my dad's, like, on his phone. He has this, like, super serious face when he gets intense, and he's just on his phone. He's not really saying anything. And eventually, I don't think he ever said anything, and then he got up and left the room.
What's it like for you when he does, like, walk away like that?
I felt dumbfounded. I felt angry. I felt really confused. Because, he can feel like a brick wall, but this is a brick wall that's, like, literally walking away.
This is how Tristan's dad talks, with long pauses between thoughts or just nothing at all. Silence. Tristan says it can come across as demeaning, not to mention make conversation difficult. He had an especially hard time understanding this when he was younger, before his parents found out about his ADHD. He'd act out, get in trouble, and in place of counseling, Tristan would get advice like this from his dad.
Like, just do your homework, just go to school, like, it's not that hard, this and that. And then it's just happened enough times where, like, when I hear him, all I can think about is those bad times, and I just get angry easily.
All this left Tristan with a longing for something more out of their relationship. And when his dad did try reaching out, things never really clicked. Tristan had unresolved feelings, like any teenager.
He tried to, like, talk to me, I guess, like, a little bit, like, as I was growing up. And it was really, it just, like, it always felt like too little too late. And then I was kind of just felt like I kind of just, like, walk away or just shut him down, really, especially in high school.
Around this time, Tristan was starting to come into his own. He took the energy that got him into trouble at home and poured it into his community, volunteering, sitting on youth boards, identifying more as a person of color. But in the midst of all this self-discovery, Tristan developed some serious mental health issues. A huge depression set in, and with seemingly nowhere to go, Tristan's thoughts turned to suicide.
I was just stuck in such a dark place. Like, I felt like I was stuck, like, in this pit, like, forever, and I couldn't even see, like, any light at the top of it. So, I told my therapist that, like, enough times, and she's just like, we need to get you to Children's.
That's Seattle Children's Hospital. Tristan stayed in their inpatient psych ward, and it's where things started to turn around for him. One day, he received a packet with a bunch of coping strategies. There was one in particular that caught his attention.
And just one of them was radical acceptance.
Radical acceptance. I'll let Tristan explain.
It just means, like, when you really disagree with somebody on something, or, like, in you're in a bad, like, environment that you can't really get out of, or, yeah, you just kind of, like, accept, like, this is what it is, and I'm going to deal with it. Like, I can't just get away from it.
After Tristan was released, he started applying this mindset when it came to his dad.
We have a cultural gap, a generational gap, and I just have to accept that. I can't really connect to my dad like other kids are able to connect to some of their dads.
Just knowing this has been enough to change the relationship. It's not a complete overhaul. The two still have their issues, but it's definitely helped.
I don't really get angry anymore. I just keep the conversation short, let him get, like, the quick facts he needs. And I'll be like, oh, do you guys have any more questions? It feels weird, but, like, yeah, I just kind of get, like, formal with it. I'd say that we're, like, a pretty good place because I accept, like, how our relationship works and I don't try to change it.
Tristan and his dad go to the movies a lot nowadays. Afterwards, they'll get something to eat. It's the right balance of silence and conversation. Time the two can spend together without needing anything to change.
That story from sound effect contributor Max Wasserman. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Found in Translation. Dominic Civitelli grew up on a farm.
And it was a beautiful place to grow up, and so we had all ranges of animals with a really ancient forest, with a really majestic river there. And so that there was just this an incredible amount of adventure to my childhood. That was my backyard. And so my mind always kind of drifted to, like, where the hell did this all come from?
Dominic is a grad student at the University of Washington these days, and what drew him there was this fascination with biodiversity, the whole wide sweep of life on Earth, and especially how different life forms think, what he calls cognitive complexity.
My two main interests that came out of that was the evolution of the mind and then life itself, so the origin of life itself.
This is probably a good time to mention that Dominic and I met up at a conference on astrobiology, meaning the study of life beyond Earth. He got here partly because of revelations he had while studying invertebrates at Friday Harbor Lab. That research led him to this thought. We can better imagine what an alien intelligence looks like if we more clearly understand some of the aliens among us.
And they didn't really seem to be easily reconciled until when I was at Friday Harbor Labs a few years ago, and I was in a class that studied marine invertebrate zoology. I was taking this class because I was interested in the diversity of the nervous system. Like, let's actually give a perspective on the forms that the mind can take, probably on worlds beyond our own. This was a world that we didn't evolve to see. It seems really alien to us, and these marine invertebrates seem really alien to us. And of all the invertebrates that were in that lab that I was studying, there was one that was seemingly studying me as much as I was studying it.
And that creature was an octopus.
So it dawned on me that, like, among this incredible diversity of form and mind, there was something of particular unique cognitive complexity that seemed very fascinating to me because of how distant it was. And it became clear that the octopus can be used as a model for understanding alternative evolutionary paths toward intelligence. It was small. It snuck its way into our lab in a bivalve shell. So,
wait, what?
Yeah, it was weird. The instructors went out diving to get some clams, and this thing, like, popped out of its clamshell. Like, it had made its home in this clamshell, and so suddenly there was this octopus in the lab. So suddenly the IQ of the lab just shot up a whole bunch.
Wait, how big are we talking about here?
Oh, like, it'd probably fit on your thumb pretty easily. It was a small one. But yeah, she didn't live, and that was really unfortunate. But I had discovered something when I was like looking at her and looking at her camouflage system on her skin, because, like, once the animals die, their camouflage system tend to stay active. And I didn't know this until I was looking at her, and I saw, like, her chromatophore system, which are those ink filled sacs that are basically the pixels of their camouflage system. They began to fire. Just randomly, just waves of red and waves of yellow, waves of orange. Just started.
So it's just changing color in front of your eyes?
Yeah. And she was dead. And she still showed all this incredible beauty. And so, yeah, it was just a lot all at once to, like, see both the cognitive sophistication of this animal, but also just, like, how even in death, this camouflage system was still active for a while afterwards, for hours afterwards. So there was something very different, computationally speaking, about this animal, at the neural level about this animal. And so I had to start to look at their nervous system. It has been for over 500 million years that the octopus has evolved in parallel, a cognitive complexity. And so all these different forms of cognition were selected for by the environment, right? So all forms of intelligence are selected for by the environment. There was some adaptive value, there was some reproductive value to our way of thinking about the world.
So we have hundreds of millions of years of progress then along separate tracks toward being smart, or toward being sufficiently complex that you could do complicated tasks and behaviors in your environment, right? But they arrived at such different places. So can you just give me a thumbnail of then what, say, an octopus's nervous system looks like compared with, say, a lab rat?
there is evolved to being incredibly diffuse. Unlike the highly centralized nervous system of the vertebrates, most of the octopus's nervous system exists within its arms. And this allows it to outsource a large amount of computation that the brain would have to do. The arms of the octopus can bend in any direction anywhere along their length. And so that's a really hard computational problem if you want to control that.
Because you got to get them to work together and not knock into each other and do something that you want them to do and not stuff you don't want to do, right?
Yeah, imagine with our limbs, we have very few fixed joints. And so the degrees of freedom, the coordinates of where our body is, we don't really have to think that hard about. But when your arm can bend in any direction, anywhere down its length, that becomes a much more difficult computational problem. So the brain sent that problem out to the arm itself by providing the arms and the suckers with their own localized computation centers called ganglia.
And so those are neural bodies, right? Neural clumps of neurons and so on, and they exist not only we have nerves all over our body too, but these are concentrated, it seems like, in ways that they aren't in, say, my arm.
Correct, yeah. Yeah, so these are localized sensory and motor computation centers. And so in these ganglia where most of the neurons of the octopus's nervous system is. So most of that information doesn't make it to the brain at all.
So what does having this information that there's a very different type of organism that has established cognitive complexity in a really different way than vertebrates have? We're sitting here talking at this astrobiology conference. Astrobiology, of course, the study of habitable worlds and what one might find there and how one might find them and so on. What are you doing here?
I'm here to put a perspective on the diversity of forms the mind can take on worlds beyond our own. Because, again, we probably won't find humans out there. And people should understand that we might find something that looks more like an octopus. We might find something that looks more like a yeast. I'm interested in what are those life forms thinking about and how are they thinking? This is just a very human thing to do is just turn our questions to the unknown and be okay with not actually getting an answer. Life is, in a way, an information reactor. Life can process information like nothing else in the universe, and things with nervous systems can do so at a completely different scale entirely.
So can I poke you on something then? Because you talked at the beginning about the idea that this octopus was studying you as much as you were studying it. And I know you're not anthropomorphizing it literally, but to what extent do you imagine it as an agent?
That's an interesting question. I'd say that there are these characteristics that we share that either endured through our separate evolutionary paths or that we converged on, that we both evolved separately. And one of those is undoubtedly curiosity. They are immensely curious animals. Exploration is built into their nervous system. Their arms will explore just like instinctually. So that's something that I felt right away. This mutual interest in the unknown. That's really where I felt our kinship. And so that really made it clear to me that when we have these common characteristics in different evolutionary paths toward intelligence, maybe those characteristics are going to be shared when those intelligent life forms will have a completely different origin entirely. So maybe on other worlds, other forms of cognition, other forms of intelligence will share the curiosity and the interest in the unknown that we share with the octopus.
Dominic Civitelli is a PhD student in behavioral neuroscience at the University of Washington. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's theme is Found in Translation. Nayroli Price moved to Seattle from Cape Town, South Africa last year. The two cities have a lot in common. They're both surrounded by sea and mountains, and you can speak English in both of them. But as Nayroli found out, there is one major difference that she wasn't expecting.
When I boarded the bus on Saturday the 19th of January, I noticed that something was different. People weren't glued to their phones. They were talking excitedly to each other while adjusting their pink hats and comparing handmade signs. I was on my way to the 3rd National Women's March in Seattle. And as I took my seat, I thought about what lay ahead of me. The first march of its kind was in 2017, and it was the biggest single-day demonstration in U.S. history. All over the world, people marched in solidarity, even in my hometown at the tip of the African continent. But that was then. Today, as I got off the bus, I had nervous butterflies in my stomach. As an outsider, was it my place to join this protest at all? And what about the police? How would they react? But my trepidation began to subside as I joined the crowds at Cal Anderson Park. Everywhere I looked, there were babies in strollers and dogs on leashes. It felt like a family picnic. And even though this was my first time protesting in Seattle, being part of the Women's March felt familiar. And that's because I recently moved here from the protest capital of the world, South Africa. Our democracy is just 25 years old. Before 1994, South Africa was ruled by a white minority government that instituted the policy of apartheid. The word literally means separateness. Racism was the law. Taking to the streets became the only way for black South Africans to be seen and heard. For South Africans, protesting is an intergenerational legacy. Even for me, a privileged white woman. And that's because my parents were active in the struggle against apartheid. In fact, their activism led them both to Europe and each other. They met there in 1987. My father had faced prison time for refusing to serve in the apartheid military and had fled into exile. And my mother had been harassed by the police for dating across the racial divide, an offense that could land you in jail. They returned with me as a baby in 1991, only after Nelson Mandela had been released and it was safe to return home.
I, Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela, do hereby swear to be faithful to the Republic of South Africa.
My parents took me to my first protest when I was just 2 years old. Since then, I have marched many times. And often, they're the ones giving me advice about surviving the tear gas. Despite the promises of our new democratically elected government, many people still don't have access to basic services like housing or running water. And in response to these and other failures by those in power, there have been as many as 3 protests per day in recent years. But it's not just the numbers that make South Africa the protest capital of the world. It's also the way that we make ourselves heard. We have a very distinct protest style. It's called the toy toy. And it's kind of a rhythmic march, accompanied by singing, whistling, clapping, and chanting. The sound that you're hearing comes from the documentary Amandla, A Revolution in Four-Part Harmony. The toy toy is best described as a war dance of sorts. The movement of lifting your legs high in the air keeps the blood pumping and your energy high. The synchronized movement is also unifying and connects you to your fellow protesters. To outsiders, South African protest can feel militaristic. Fellow protesters are called comrades or cadres, and the crowd is disciplined by a call and response. A shout of power in isiXhosa is responded to with, "To the people!"
Manda! Manda!
This is so different to what I experienced in Seattle. The Women's March felt like a celebration, a place for friends to catch up, grab coffee, and take selfies. It was a moment to be proud of, but it didn't feel desperate or threatening. In South Africa, you will know that the police are typically armed to the teeth in riot gear. They ride around in these imposing tank-like structures nicknamed hippos and caspers, and they often use violence in the form of stun grenades, tear gas, water cannons, and rubber bullets to break up a march. But on that cold, gray Seattle morning at the Women's March, that felt like a world away. Here, police were pedaling alongside us on bicycles. They were at the back of the crowd, acting as sweepers and chatting casually to the protesters. In this predominantly white privileged space, I felt safe and protected by the police. There was no confrontation, no tension, no violence, and no sense of urgency. It felt more like a parade than a protest. Later on the bus ride home, I felt satisfied. It had been a fun event. It felt like a safe and inclusive space, and seeing the families at the march had warmed my heart. But something had been missing. And in that moment, I realized that what I had grown up with, what had always felt natural to me, was so specific to a time and a place. That's the definition of home. It's the very first template that you have. The one that you see the world through. The one you don't even know is there until it's gone. I may be walking in the streets of a city called London.
Nairoli Price lives in Seattle. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner, with help this week from Nairoli Price, Max Wasserman, and Kari Ploeg. Our executive producer is Florangela Davila. One more reminder, come join us at the Grand Cinema in Tacoma on Wednesday, October 16th for a screening of War Games. You can get ticket info on the calendar at knkx.org. Sound Effect is shelf stable. We don't go bad. So you can dig way back into our archive by subscribing to our podcast. Find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, NPR One, or wherever. And we love to hear your feedback. Send it to soundeffect@knkx.org. We're back next week when our theme is The Gatekeeper. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX. People ask me where I'm from. I say I'm in Lodi Township, in a city called Tswane, meaning we are the same. I have a friend who's a great musician and is from Ebayi, near King Williamstown. You know where Steve Biko was born. Might have heard or seen a film about